Hi everyone, before we get started, I want to let you know that Patricia Martin, host of Young in the World, will be leading a writing workshop called The Inner Prompt on Friday, May 10th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Young Institute in downtown Chicago. To learn more about that workshop and to register, just click the link in the show notes or go to youngchicago.org. Thanks.
This is Patricia Martin, and I'm your host for Young in the World. Our guest today is Natalie Goldberg, a lifelong student of Zen Buddhism and the author of 15 books. For the last 40 years, she has practiced Zen and taught seminars in writing as a spiritual practice. She lives in northern New Mexico. For more information about her and her books, you can find her at nataliegoldberg.com. Being in the virtual presence of Natalie Goldberg's wonderfully wise and creative mind lends itself easily to Jungian themes such as active imagination, individuation, and the forward striving function. Natalie Goldberg, after all these years of reading your work, it's a true joy to sit down with you. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
When I began reading your memoir, it struck me that you've been thinking about the limits of mortality for quite a while. You mentioned the death of your Zen master, which happened nearly 30 years after you published Let the Whole Thundering World Come Home. His passage seemed to leave its mark on you that underscored the value of life. This stuck with me. You wrote, "Don't waste your life." Was that wisdom easy to grasp when you were healthy and harder to hang on to when you were seriously ill?
Actually, no. Now it's harder. While I'm old and I've been I've been going to therapy with a Jungian therapist for 20 years, and she had health issues and stopped suddenly, and I was tossed out. And that has been stunning for me. And I realized that I wasn't paying attention for the last few months, that there were signs that she wasn't okay and she wasn't going to come back. You know, because you have this idea when you're young, you get a scratch and it heals. But as you get older, something can go wrong. And it keeps going wrong, you know, rather than getting better. And I realized I was still thinking she was going to get better. And it's been very painful for me. And I'm absorbing it now, understanding, but I never imagined it. And I never imagined 20 years is a long time to be with someone. And I'm really having to digest it. So when you say, do not waste your life, I feel it more strong. I think I felt it more strongly then when I had cancer. I had lots of mojo still. And now I'm kind of stunned by it all. Because one of the things about Zen that I learned when I was 30, old age, sickness, and death. But I didn't really absorb it. I was too young. I'm absorbing it now, and I do not like. There are many translations, do not waste your life. But Upaya Zen Center has just translated it to do not squander your life. And I love that verb, squander, because we can really toss it away, you know, just not be conscious. And I like the verb squander better. But either way, we just have a life. We live it the best we can. And then we get older and realize, what do you know?
Well, you don't strike me, after all the books you have written, a unique approach that you've developed toward teaching writing. You've touched millions of people with your work. It's hard for me to use the word squander there for you.
Okay. People mistake the writer from the human being. The writer doesn't get old or die. She can write about it, but it's the human being that lives her daily life. Do you know what I mean? You're presenting yourself as a writer in books. I'm not dishonest. All that I say is true, but you could say it's I wouldn't say my better self. I would say my deeper self. But I also carry with me my discursive mind of yada, 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 and my childhood and being a Jew and having to deal with all that. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. One of my favorite writers, Edna O'Brien, in an interview about her last novel, which she wrote when she was 90, she was asked if she had another book in her. And she pondered it a bit and said, you know, perhaps. And I'm curious to know, based on what you just said about who you are as a writer, what keeps you going?
There's nothing else. It's the best thing around. It's the most true, the most, you really get to meet your mind and figure things out. That's what it is. I just have a new book that's going to come out in July called Writing on Empty, Remembering What Matters. And it's about the COVID years and what happened to me. Natalie, the person, just kind of slugged her way through and remembered I couldn't go to a cafe, I couldn't do this, I was miserable, blah, blah, blah. But in the writing, I put it all together and understood it on a much more deep level about what was going on for me. And what was going on, in a way, a possibility for people during the COVID years, when everything is taken away, not everything, but a lot is taken away. What do you do? Maybe I'll have 20 minutes where I understand something. That's the writer. But then there's the human being. It's not any different than my therapist, who was brilliant as a therapist. But as she began to disintegrate really in front of my eyes, of course, I didn't want to notice, but I did. She was very human. And she wasn't as intelligent about me, which is why I went to her.
I would be remiss, Natalie, if I didn't pick up on the fact that you just shared you have been in Jungian analysis for 20 years, and I promise not to get personal, but depth analysis is a different engagement with the psyche, and I'm wondering how that helped you be a writer.
Oh, I don't know how it helped me be a writer. It helped me be a human being. Okay, I want to explain this. One end was Katagiri Roshi, my Zen teacher, who I intensely studied with for 12 years. There was nothing personal there. At the end of 12 years, I don't think he knew I had a sister, that I came from Brooklyn, what my father did for a living. He didn't know anything personal. I learned about a structure and a way of being in the world, and I sat a lot. And I met my human mind. Okay, so I was very clear in that area, teaching, writing, was quite clear, but I knew in intimacy, it didn't help me. And it didn't help me because I was split. Now I can say, after all that analysis, I hated my mother. And I cut that off. I didn't know that it mattered or was important. And so do you understand? The Zen practice didn't heal that or transform it, or there was nothing personal about it. So I needed that other element, in a way, the specific of my life. And that happened in therapy.
So you were able to integrate the part of your story that you had split off.
Yeah, I hope so. I always knew there was a split. I knew there was something we weren't getting to, but I didn't know how to get to it. And I was very happy practicing Zen.
Well, you talk about your experiences with Zen throughout your memoir, and I love the way you sprinkle, Zen encouragement to exert your force, the force of your life. Carl Jung wrote about that, as well as the forward striving function that propels us. It connects us to our aliveness. And, illness can really sap you of that. It can, talk about the word separate, it can separate you from those energies. How did you find the energy to keep your creativity alive during your fight with cancer?
Zen really helped me with that. First of all, my writing is a practice, like you do a Zen practice. It is a Zen practice. And I've done it since I was 30, and I've taught it for 35 years. So you don't expect, when you have cancer, you still brush your teeth. That actually is a practice. You brush your teeth every day. We don't call it a practice, but it is. So I wrote regularly, so it didn't stop me. I kept writing. As a matter of fact, I wrote, before I wrote this memoir, I wrote a book called The Great Spring that I was essays that I wanted to make sure, if I died, that these would be recorded. And then when I knew I wasn't going to die, I was going to make it through. Then I turned and wrote about cancer. But what helped me was, number one, cancer was not my enemy. I did not fight cancer. I understood that it lived in me, and actually had been living in me for 20 years. I knew something was wrong with me. And I always would go to doctors, and my friends would get sick and they'd be better in 6 days. I take the same stuff, the herbal stuff, and it didn't work at all. And I'd be sick for 6 weeks. I knew I had a different immune system, but I couldn't find out what was wrong. But I never imagined it was cancer. So I understood that cancer had been living in me for a long time. I'm not going to say it was my friend, but when I knew that I was going to take this ibrutinib, which turned out worked, and it stops the protein from the main protein that the cancer needs to survive. I think I say it in the book. I say to the cancer, hey, get out now. I said, get out now, because soon they're going to destroy you. Was never my enemy.
So I want to talk to you now about your teaching, because you've been teaching for, what did you say, 25 years?
Oh, no, 50.
Oh, 50.
Writing down the bones, I've been known and flying around for 35.
Right. And when you say writing down the bones, that was your breakthrough book.
For everyone else, it was. In other words, I'd been doing that work for much longer. It was very scary for me. And I got rejected by everybody. All the New York publishers made fun of me. Usually they send just a a regular slip that's printed out. No, we don't want you. But I think they were so threatened by writing down the Barnes that they wrote me mean letters.
Really?
Yeah, and I was in my 30s. And unfortunately, I wish I'd kept them now. I threw them out quickly because I was afraid. And I didn't realize at that point when I wrote it, I had been with Katagiri Roshi 10 years, practicing like a maniac, you know, sitting all the time, 5 a.m., you know, just sitting a lot. And so I was leaking Zen. So really, the writing the book taught me what I had been practicing. Does that make sense? So I, in writing, I understood. When I practiced with Katagiri and in the 70s, nobody in the U.S. knew anything about Zen. You couldn't go and read books about it. You had to practice. Now everybody is a know-it-all.
Yes, but this is interesting to me that, you know, the Tweedy publishing world found writing down the bones threatening. What's threatening about it?
Well, I think that it was threatening. I say that it was threatening. All I know is they hated it and were mean, wrote mean letters. And I think then, you see, you're forgetting, in the mid-80s, writing was still about something magical where you were at the top of a mountain, you know, mostly male, hit by lightning. And I was making writing simply a practice, like brushing your teeth. I was saying that everyone could do it. Not everyone was going to become a writer, but it was available to everyone. It's so part of the culture now that you question it. You know, why would anybody, why would it matter? But at the time, it was not part of the culture. There was nobody in the schools I went to who could teach me writing. I had to go to Zen to find it.
So what can you share with us about this approach you take to teaching?
I tell them to shut up, keep their hand moving, and we also meditate. And usually I like to meet with people for 5 days and on silence. There's no talking.
Yes, and this is, you know, this breaks the mold of workshopping a piece with a group of writers. And
yeah, that I couldn't stand. And it turns out other people don't like it either, including the teachers who are teaching it.
Yeah, it's very true. I would have to say that's been my experience as well. I love reading some of the stories in your memoir about other writers. And you talk about Carson McCullers.
Well, Carson McCullers, I adore. And we read Ballad of a Sad Cafe in 9th grade. And that changed my life. It was 70 pages. And I think I'm a writer because of that book. And I was nothing like Miss Amelia, who was about 6'3". She went cockeyed. She lived in the South. And she fell in love with Cousin Lyman, who I think was, I can't remember, but maybe was 4'9". And I mean, it was amazing characters. And it was about the lover and the beloved. Looking back now, it's also the only book by a woman I read in all of high school and most of college. I majored in English Lit. You had to major in English Lit at the time, not American Lit. And it was all dead white men from England. So even though I loved it, there was nothing of my experience reflected in there or that I could write about.
Well, you tell this story about the Danish writer, Isaac Dinesen, who wrote Out of Africa. And she takes a visit to the United States. She has to meet specific people. So she wants to meet Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn Monroe brings with her Arthur Miller, who was her then husband and famous playwright. And they go to Carson McCullough's home.
In Nyack, New York.
And Dinesen has arranged for a luncheon that should consist of only three things: white grapes, white wine, and white scallops. So she obviously, this is what she thought consisted of a well-lived life, to consume these things with three people you really enjoy. And I couldn't help but wonder, after your prolific career, and it's still going strong, what do you think are the three things that constitute a well-lived life?
Oh, that's a great question. I just want to say, Isaac Dinesen, it was aesthetic for her. Three white things. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't about, and I have to say, at the end of her tour, she ended up in the hospital with anemia. And so you're asking me, what are three well-lived things?
Yes. What are the three things that constitute a well-lived life for you?
This is an incredible question. Okay. Being connected to nature, having a real connection to nature. I guess I've been sitting so long, it's so natural to me, like brushing my teeth, but certainly being able to sit still, sit completely still, and have something that you continue with under all circumstances. You know, someone asked Suzuki Roshi, what is nirvana? And he said, Suzuki Roshi is the Zen master who came and started San Francisco Zen Center and wrote Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. He didn't write it. Someone edited his talks. But he, the answer to what is nirvana, to take something and see it all the way through to the end. And at first, I thought, of course, it meant what I think of writing, continue right to the end. And I've told students, I want you to go out writing. That's how severe a practice. And actually, two students I have did die and did go out writing. But what I realize now is whatever you do, be there. That's it. Be there. And, you know, the old example, if you cut a carrot, cut the carrot. Cry when you cry. Walk when you walk. Eat when you eat. Die when you die. You know, just be there.
So that presence that you're talking about, to be there, it strikes me that that's what you're asking people to do in your workshops, is to be fully present to that material that's coming up. Are you helping them tap into the unconscious for that material?
You know, it's funny. I never use the word unconscious. It's so available. More what I think, and I teach them how to be present. And it's a practice. Yada, yada, yada. We have discursive thinking. And through practice, you can drop to those deeper levels that are right there in every moment. And our body is no place else. You might be thinking about Spain, but you're right here in Brooklyn. So it's understanding how the mind works. Because what are the tools of a writer? Pen, paper, and the human mind. Where do memories come from? Where do thoughts come from? So the more you have a relationship with your human mind, the better you can use it for writing. So maybe you'd call that the unconscious. I've never used that word any.
So you've got a new book coming out soon. What's the title again? Do you have it?
Yeah. Writing on Empty, Remembering What Matters. And I'm very proud of it, very happy, and I love the book. And I went much deeper into Carson McCullers in one chapter, one part. I made them into parts. I went much deeper into Carson McCullers. Why Natalie, is she so important? From ninth grade till now, she is. And of course, I love many, many writers now. I'm much more sophisticated than that ninth grader. But I still really honor her. Thank you, Carson. She died very young, 50, and she had her first stroke when she was in her 20s.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So she wrote despite her stroke.
Yeah, well, that was a stroke, and then she recovered, but it kept happening. And she wrote to the, she came from, Columbus, South Carolina, this small town, and she wrote to the library there in the 50s or 60s and said, I will give you all my papers, which probably now is worth millions of dollars, if you allow Negro people to come into the library. And they said no and rejected her papers. Well, it was a very racist place at the time, and that's why she went north.
So as the society develops and the collective gets more and more conscious, I mean, you brought it up yourself. You studied with a Zen master when you were very young. And at the time, that was a difficult thing to do. You had to, didn't you travel back to Minnesota to do that work?
Well, I moved to Minnesota to get married. I had been with Trungpa Rinpoche in Boulder. It was a Tibetan teacher. But when I went to Minneapolis, I thought, whoever's here, I'll study with them. And I was very lucky. I really met my real teacher, Katagirishi. And I was burning. I was during that hip. I was a hippie. So I had the freedom to not worry about things. And I always follow what you love, and it'll take you where you need to go. I was burning to study. Now, it killed me. You know, I had to get up at 5. I had to be there at 5 a.m. every day. And I didn't have to. You didn't have to do anything. But when I met him, he was the hottest thing around. You know, I'd go to readings and stuff, and they were wonderful, but nothing was like Katagiri Roshi.
Now, as you're a more seasoned writer and human being, do you still burn for things?
Yeah, I'm afraid I do. Yeah.
What do you burn for, Natalie Goldberg?
Well, I was burning to go swimming in the summer. You're supposed to be in water, and I live in New Mexico that has no water. So I'm burning to go to the ocean. I'm burning. I love to look at art. I paint. I've painted for a long time, but I just love to look at paintings, go to art museums. And I haven't been traveling as much since COVID. And I'm sort of burning to go to the places I used to go.
Well, I have to say, Natalie Goldberg, we were burning to get you on this show.
You are so sweet.
No, it's true. It's true. I confess that I read Writing Down the Bones, and you're right. It's a big departure from literary disciplines that get taught around the country in MFA programs. You really took a fresh approach to how to tap into what Carl Jung would call, you know, our active imagination. You're really dipping into a part of yourself that is a font, if you can find your way to that. And so it has felt that way too, talking with you today, that we were dipping into something very deep and profound. And I want to thank you. for sharing your thoughts and your wisdom on this show with us today.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like more information about training programs, live and self-study courses, archives, this podcast, our blog, or to find Jungian analysts near you, visit our website, jungchicago.org. Thank you to our 2023 donors who gave at the contributor level or above. Barbara Anand, Nuni Alka, April Barrett, Arlo Compan, Judith Cooper, Lorna Crowell, David Dalrymple, Kevin Davis, Dr. Peter DeMuth, Mary Doherty, Christine Foskett, Britta W. Jacobson, Mary Ann Johnson, Mary W. Liebman, Mona Manning, Patricia Martin, Boris Matthews, Kenan McKee, Sue Rosenthal, David O. Stats, Lawrence C. Tingley, Don Troyer, Robert Ulrich, Alexander Wayne and Lynn Cobb, Gerald Weiner, William Wolf, and Ellen Young. You can support this podcast by making a donation at our website, jungchicago.org.